Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm Michael O'Hanlon, and had the great pleasure of writing this book about Afghanistan that we're going to talk about today with a woman named Hasina Sherjan, and I'll tell you more about her in just a second. But I want to not only welcome you on behalf of Brookings Foreign Policy Program, Martin Indyk, 21 CDI program, but also thank my good friends and colleagues, Martha Raddatz and Bruce Rydell, for being part of this discussion today. Martha's going to moderate. As you know, she's a distinguished, award-winning, and extremely combat-hardened journalist for ABC News, who's also going through some additional combat hardening these days, planning her daughter's wedding.
Much harder.
Exactly. And Bruce Rydell, who I'm very proud to be colleagues with here at Brookings, as you know, chaired the president's Afghanistan-Pakistan policy review last winter, although everything he says today is on his own account. And he's presently working on a book on Pakistan, one of his areas of longstanding expertise and interest, and he'll certainly be discussing that in the course of the morning. Let me just say one more word before turning things over to Martha, which is that Hasina Sherjan, my co-author, who's not here today, is back in Kabul, is a very impressive woman, and I wish there were a movie made about her like Kite Runner, because she's that kind of character. She grew up in Afghanistan to an important political family of the mid-20th century, at the time when Afghanistan was a bit of a country, despite many allegations to the contrary, that Afghanistan has never been a state, never had any kind of central government, the kind of critique you sometimes hear from skeptics of the possibility of any success in this country. But Hasina and her family had to flee in the late 70s, at the time of unrest and the communist takeover and then Soviet invasion, and spent much of the 90s in California, 80s and 90s in California, but then started going back to Afghanistan in the late 90s during Taliban control, first requesting permission to build girls' schools, and then doing it anyway when she couldn't. So she's somewhere between a Kite Runner and a Craig Mortensen kind of character. And on top of that, she's a businesswoman now trying to run a business in Kabul in addition to this NGO for girls' education. And so I followed the old Peter Fleming rule, for those of you who are tennis fans, the Peter Fleming rule of how to be a good doubles team. And when they asked Peter Fleming, how do you play doubles? Well, he said, easy, choose John McEnroe as your partner. And so that's what I did by choosing Hasina and by choosing Martha and Bruce as co-panelists today. So thank you both for doing this. Thank you all for being here. And Martha, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Bruce and Michael are always our go-to experts at ABC and always offer such depth and insight. And they also offer what I say. It doesn't matter how smart someone is. If you can't really explain things on TV, you're getting nowhere. And both of them are so fantastic at explaining to people who, adding depth to those who know something about a subject and really being concise and wonderful to those who want to learn something more. I, of course, have traveled to Afghanistan many times and Pakistan as well. So, and this is a pretty easy job for me, definitely easier than Mother of the Bride, because basically I get to turn it over to them and turn it over to you and sit and smile, although today I will be the one sniffling if you hear that in the background, because I am today fighting a cold, not just everything else, so apologies for that. I want to start with the news of the day, and if you've all heard, there was an airstrike that killed perhaps a couple of dozen of Afghan civilians. And in general, what I've been watching over the last few weeks is this discussion certainly about rules of engagement. I think there was a piece this weekend about, is air power really relevant in this war at all? Have they really taken that away from this war because General McChrystal wants to be so careful with avoiding civilian casualties? And Michael and I were talking beforehand. We both remembered in Iraq when General Peter Corelli, who was the number two over there at the time, tried to change the rules of engagement and was heavily criticized by soldiers' families, for pretty much the same thing, trying to have people stop and just take a pause before you fire. If you'll just talk about what effect you think this has and where we're going from that, Michael.
Well, you know, it's, as you say, Martha, a hugely important subject. It's difficult to discuss today, not only because of the sadness of the humanitarian side of things, but because the dearth of information. We still don't know what platform was used, who called in the airstrike, or who fired the weapon. We appear to know that there were three vehicles struck, and including some women and children killed, and about 25 to 27 fatalities. I guess all I can say is to put this in a little bit of perspective. This is obviously horrible on any number of grounds. But, of course, we have to be braced for this occasionally happening. It's war. Even if one tries to restrict the number of times when air power can be called in to only situations where soldiers are under direct threat, every so often a civilian or two or three will be killed. And there may be a case, and today may have been one, although I don't know yet, where there was just a simple mistake made. And soldiers were not under threat, and something terrible happened. And we'll have to find out. But that's going to happen in war as well. So I think we have to, frankly, just remember and recognize that we are in an ongoing combat operation. This is in no way the kind of thing McChrystal's going to be telling his soldiers today. He's going to be chewing them out, I'm sure. Or at least he's going to be trying to get to the bottom of it and then be critical of whatever lack of adequate rigor went into the selection of targets. Because he knows better than anybody, from my experience, how serious of a blow this is to our efforts to make progress with the Afghan people. So all I can say is, in addition to these obvious points, that mistakes will happen, that we don't know yet what really happened in this case, but that we have to be braced for more of this, that McChrystal is going to be more on top of this than anyone, because he knows that whether it's fair or not to take this kind of an issue and magnify it in the way the war is seen by the Afghan people, that will happen. And let me just finish with one statistic on 2009, which is both encouraging and sobering. The statistic is the UN estimate of the number of Afghan civilians inadvertently killed by NATO air power and other heavy ordnance, and it was about 600 people. Now, that is encouraging in the sense in two ways. One, that's less than the 800 estimated to have been killed the same way in 2008. And secondly, it's actually remarkably small in absolute terms, given the nature of the conflict, the number of NATO troops involved, the number of fatalities that NATO troops suffered in 2009, which was about 500. And so by any kind of objective measure or historical standard, this is a very low number. That doesn't in any way change the fact that this could be, in many ways, the number one greatest vulnerability we have as a coalition, that future days like this are one of the few ways I could see us still losing this war. I'm a relative optimist, but this kind of thing, many more of these, as Admiral Mullen himself said on this stage about a year and a half ago, and we could wind up failing because of the perceptions working against us as they do after this kind of tragedy.
Michael, can I just add, though, one of the things, and we deal with this as well, sometimes there are no civilians killed, and the Taliban or whoever will say there were civilians killed. So is this a battle we can really win, and is there evidence in these, and Bruce, if you want to get in on this as well, but we'll leave Pakistan to you. Is there evidence that if civilians are killed in a certain place, that that village, that town, that tribe turns against the U.S.? So first of all, the perception, whether we kill civilians or not, and second of all, what kind of evidence do we see that that really does make a difference?
I probably don't have on the tip of my tongue a case study to prove the point, but it certainly is the consensus view among NATO intelligence that the inadvertent killing of civilians is one of the two or three things, along with corruption and favoritism, perhaps, that most help the Taliban in recruiting. And so I'm really just expressing a general conclusion here as opposed to giving you detailed evidence. But that certainly is viewed as, again, one of the two or three best ways for the Taliban to recruit. And certainly the story of the 8 years so far is us trying to do a lot of things from long range with these kinds of strikes that wind up killing bad guys, but also innocents, and look where we are today as a result.
But go to that next point, that whether we do or not, they still get out there that we did.
Yeah, fighting the information warfare battle is very hard for us because we naturally want to go with the facts and the truth, whereas the Taliban basically wants to go with the message that NATO is behaving like an occupation army. I think General McChrystal and his people recognize this, but it's a very difficult cycle to get inside of. There's another downside, of course, to these as well, which is their impact back in Europe especially. The bombing that took place in Kunduz in the German area in the north a few months ago, in which a significant number of civilians were killed, has had a very devastating impact on German support for the war. And, one of the battlefields of this war is in Afghanistan, another battlefield of this war is in the United States, Canada, and Europe trying to maintain popular support for it. And, you know, casualty attacks like this undermine support for the war.
And let's switch over the border there, speaking of attacks, that the United States has had some tremendous success. In fact, I would think it was about the most significant success that the U.S. has had in 8 years in Afghanistan, going after the Taliban, Mullah Baradar.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about that. And really, is what we're seeing a change in Pakistan's thinking? I'm wondering whether they knew quite who they had there.
Right. Well, first of all, it is a huge event. The capture of Mullah Baradar could probably be said to be the most significant accomplishment we've had in 8 years of this war. Why? Because this man is the operational commander of the Taliban. He is number two to Mullah Omar. Mullah Omar has always been a somewhat remote figure since he was sent into exile from Kandahar in 2001. He's become even more remote. He operates at the realm of giving very broad religious, theological instructions and very, very broad strategic direction. Mullah Baradar, on the other hand, actually commanded the Taliban, and he is the place, he is the focal point where information came together. So this is the man who will know things like who is the commander in one district, where are the logistics supply routes, where are the safe havens, where are we getting our money from, all of those kinds of critical pieces of information. He's married to Mullah Omar's sister. He's been with the Taliban since its inception. At least before 9/11, he was one of the key focal points between al-Qaeda and the Taliban. To put it in perspective another way, a year ago, when I was chairing the strategic review, this month, a year ago, we asked the Pakistanis at the highest levels, are there any Taliban leaders in Pakistan? And from the highest levels on down, they were adamant. There are no Taliban leaders in Pakistan. If you have information, give it to us. Well, we finally called their bluff, and we got the number two. And since then, and I think this is very important, we've seen a series of follow-on arrests. Two Taliban shadow governors have been arrested in Pakistan, and there's reporting this morning that another senior Taliban official has been captured. So it's already not a one-off event. There is a fallout that's coming from it, which I think gets to the question, is this really a change in Pakistani behavior or not? The media is filled with conspiracy theories of all kinds of grand explanations for why this happened, or even the simple dumb explanation, which is that it was just good luck. I think it's more than good luck. I think that there is reason to believe that the Pakistani military has finally come to the conclusion that there is not really a lot of difference between the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban. They're now at war with the Pakistani Taliban. And as that war has progressed over the last 6 months, I think they have discovered that it's very hard to distinguish between an Afghan Taliban and a Pakistan Taliban, and that they're very close operationally and they work together. Does this mean they're going to go all out against the Afghan Taliban? It's way too soon to say. Does this mean they're going to go against other parts of the jihadist syndicate in Pakistan, like Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group that attacked Mumbai 16 months ago? Probably not. They fall into a different category. But even with those caveats on where Pakistan is going, if you'd asked me a year ago, will Pakistan arrest the number two in the Taliban, I would have said, you're dreaming. So this is a dream come true. It is a significant victory, and I think the odds of success for the NATO alliance and for President Obama's strategy went up significantly with this arrest.
And can you just, Bruce, just practically say what it means? I mean, 6 months going out, obviously it's a huge disruption for them, but practically, and that list you ticked off of what he does and right. or what he did, what that will mean?
Well, first of all, there's the disruption effect. You know, anytime you take the enemy commander off the battlefield, there is a certain amount of disruption in their command and control. Who's in charge now? The second effect is what I would call the ripple effect. Everybody in the Taliban is now looking around them and saying, okay, who ratted on Mullah Baradar and who might rat on me next? And who knows where my sanctuary is? Who knows where my hideout is? And I better go find a new hideout because I can't go to the ones I've gone to before. Then, of course, there's the information flow that may come from him, and not just from him. While the Taliban is in some ways a medieval organization, just like the rest of us, they do, you know, depend on their BlackBerry and their laptop, and he probably had some kind of electronic media with him, which is fairly easy for us to break down and penetrate. And then, of course, there's the final element, which is getting him to talk and to reveal data and information. That's probably going to take some time, but in the gentle hands of the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, I think he will probably talk.
I want to ask Michael one more question and then open it up to you, and that is the AFPAC strategy. Richard Holbrooke, bring him in. He's going to blend this all together and go after them together. Is this a result of that, or is... You can both talk about this. But.
Well, certainly, for 12 months now, this administration has been beating the Pakistanis around the head and shoulders over and over again, that you've created a jihadist Frankenstein in your country, and it's out of control. I don't think it's the eloquence of our talking points. I think they are eloquent, but I don't think that's what actually changed the situation. I think the situation on the ground persuaded the Pakistanis that the Americans were right. Now, I'll bet you a dollar that no Pakistani official is going to come forward and say, yes, the Americans were right. But action is what counts, not words in this case.
Just say a couple of words on this front. First of all, on the issue of Ambassador Holbrooke's role, I want to commend him. I've been told by a number of people in the inner workings of government that he has been a big force behind the focus on agriculture and on, frankly, leavening or lightening our drug eradication approach, which I think is smart. In other words, we used to go after the poppies wherever they were grown, whoever had opium in their possession, including the peasant farmer, which tended to drive the peasant farmer into the hands of the Taliban. Our colleague Vonda Felbad Brown has just written a great book called Shooting Up, which uses Afghanistan as one of its three case studies and talks about the difficulty of that kind of a policy working, which Ambassador Holbrooke has recognized as well, and I think put a lot of emphasis, along with Secretary Clinton, into the general concept of focusing more on agricultural development first and interference with trafficking more than eradication of the poppies themselves as the better approach. On the Pakistan dimension, I mostly prefer just to listen to Bruce, but another colleague, Steve Cohen, and I had a conference last Tuesday in Doha, Qatar, with Pakistani interlocutors on the issue of South Asia and the AFPAC concept and their view. And while it was a generally encouraging day, let me say that they assume that when Mr. Obama says he wants to start a downsizing of U.S. forces in Afghanistan by July 2011, that is yet the latest indication that America is not really committed to this part of the world. They don't believe we are that serious. Even this group of 8 or 10, very experienced, very, at least by Pakistani standards, pro-American and quite internationally aware, cosmopolitan, retired generals, ambassadors, journalists, they don't believe we're sticking it out. I could not disagree with them more. When a president triples combat forces over the course of his first 12 to 18 months in office, in the face of a lot of wariness from his own party, and after 8 years of frustrating conflict for the country as a whole, to me, that signals remarkable resoluteness. But unfortunately, in President Obama's effort to address multiple audiences, including a reluctant Congress at home, this emphasis on beginning the drawdown by July 2011, even if it's just going to be the beginning of a very gradual process in my eyes, strikes others as an indication of American skittishness. And so that is going to be something we're going to have to keep working on. And my guess is that, and this is, I think, is consistent with what Bruce just said, Pakistani collaboration with us is going to be a gradual, incremental process. It's not going to be a switch that just turns one day.
Okay, let's open it up to questions, if anyone has one. You're
I wanted to come back to this issue of collateral damage and ask, is there a tipping point where it adversely affects our ability to achieve our mission? maybe the number of times it happens or the number of people who were killed. It just seems to me that it's inevitable, given the nature of the enemy. They don't wear uniforms. They live in houses next to people who are not the enemy, those kinds of things.
Give my impression. I'll be curious for Bruce's, too. I don't know of a formula. Sarah Chase, who, as you know, was one of the most experienced American journalists in Afghanistan and then set up a company near Kandahar and then worked for General McChrystal for a time, she has this rule of thumb. You just assume that 3 to 5 insurgents are created for every innocent person killed. That's just her gut instinct. It's not a scientific rule, although it's evocative of a lot of the other counterinsurgency rules we've developed over the years, you know, the ratios of troops to population that you need in order to protect people and so forth. But I would say it probably varies province by province. And let me just give a very quick rundown of 3 provinces. In Helmand province, where, of course, we're involved now in Marja, and where we had 12 Afghan civilians killed in the inadvertent and accidental rocket strike last week, my impression is that, frankly, that's a humanitarian tragedy. It's obviously bad on every front, and yet the population of Helmand in general tends to welcome us, which is a little counterintuitive. But from what we've seen elsewhere in that province, for example, in Nawa and other areas where the Marines and Brits have established some control, we see a fairly receptive population. And so my guess is there's enough frustration with the Taliban there that as long as our mission is generally successful, that particular strike, or heaven forbid, even 1 or 2 more like it, will not preclude mission effectiveness. In Kandahar City, I think it's more to the other end of the extreme. The Taliban have their home base there. They have a lot of support there. There's a lot of wariness about the West there. It's not as anti-American as Pakistan or Sunni enclaves of Iraq in previous periods or even today. But it still is a place where every single mistake is magnified and where the Taliban has a very good public relations effort, very well established, and they do a good job. In Uruzgan province, which is where today's or yesterday's strike appears to have occurred, and our Dutch friends, I think, have done a remarkably good job along with our Australian friends, and I see representatives of each country in the audience today, and we admire your work, and a lot of us have learned from what the Dutch and Australians have done in Uruzgan. I think it's a little closer to Helmand, but a mixed bag, and different parts of Uruzgan are a little more receptive to Western presence and cooperation than others. And so we're just going to have to learn more about this particular incident. So I'm sorry to give an answer that it all depends. But the good news is, on balance, the Afghan people do have a certain amount of pro-Western inclination in their surveys and in their attitudes and the public opinion polling that's been done over the years. And that distinguishes Afghanistan from places like Iraq or Pakistan and I think gives us a chance at getting beyond these tragedies when they occur.
If I can just add a personal note here, what I've seen also, it depends on how the U.S. forces react to that. Mm-hmm. If it's a place where you can get out there and see the family and talk to people about what happened, give some sort of payment, it makes a huge difference. A lot of these things, I mean, I don't think Americans are probably going to be running around wherever this strike was today and trying to figure out who they were. But they do try to respond to them and try to beat the information operations before the Taliban gets out there and does it the other way. And I was in a convoy once, and the Humvee in front of me thought a car in Fallujah, actually, and thought the car was attacking our convoy, and he shot the driver of that car, and it turned out to be an innocent driver, but he thought the roads were supposed to be closed. They weren't. This guy came out of nowhere and shot him, and I know they did whatever they possibly could in that village to try to calm them down. Honestly, I don't know what happened after that, but I know Fallujah was pretty calm after that. It was after the invasion.
You want to comment?
Where's the microphone? I'll choose. There you are. Why don't we go right here then? See how quick I learned? Okay.
Judd Herriot, documentary filmmaker. The newspapers have been full recently about the Dutch elections and the defection of the Dutch contingent, and also making some predictions that maybe we may lose the Germans and the Canadians. Could you address yourself to this issue? Principally, what are we doing to try behind the scenes to keep that from happening, and what will happen if they do defect?
I'm glad you didn't ask me to try to explain Dutch politics, because that would be even more complicated than Afghan or Pakistani politics. But essentially, the coalition that was being asked to extend the Dutch mission again, which would be for the second time, has fallen apart, and it's highly unlikely that they'll be able to put together a new coalition in time for August, which could extend the mission. First thing I want to do is second what Mike said about the Dutch contribution. They have been one of the most effective units, and their policing and their work in Oerzgan province has really been a role model for many others to look at. The administration has been trying to persuade them to stay on. They were initially went out in 2006 for 2 years. Under a lot of pressure from the Bush administration, they extended for another 2 years in 2008. I think that book is closed, and they are going to leave in 2010. The problem is to find a follow-on replacement force. The logical candidate are the Australians, who are the junior partner in this province. But the Australians probably aren't going to do that, which means at the end of the day, probably the United States is going to have to step in and fill the gap here. We're talking about 1,600 troops, but the bigger gap is the experience gap. The Dutch have been there for 4 years. They know what they're doing. They know who the people are. And that's going to be difficult to replace. Now, as for follow-on effect, is this the first of the dominoes? The next domino that is likely to come into question is the Canadians. The Canadians have been in Kandahar now for 5 or 6 years. Kandahar is the toughest place. When the Canadians signed up for Kandahar, I suspect they didn't realize exactly what they were getting themselves into. The mission in Kandahar has been a difficult one. Canada has lost a considerable number of troops. This is the most bloody battle the Canadian Army has had since 1945. And it has stretched the Canadian Army to the limit, just trying to continually replace and have another unit ready to go to the opposite side of the world is a very difficult and taxing mission. The Canadian are supposed to come out in 2011. I'm sure the Obama administration will make every effort now to convince Ottawa to please stay on, even if for only one more year, because if the Canadians go after the Dutch, there will be this perception of a downgrading in NATO support for the mission. The Germans, there's enormous pressure within Germany, but I think the Angela Merkel government has been very clear they're not going to leave. They intend to stay there. They're an example, a good example, of how civilian casualties has a ripple effect back at home. The attack, the airstrike in Kunduz, went down very poorly back in Germany. The criticism of the German army for ordering the airstrike went down very poorly, but I think the Merkel government is probably going to stand there. You know, in the end, it comes back to something that Mike talked about, which is how do people perceive the American intent? Are we serious? Do we intend to stay? Once people begin to think that we're going to leave, then don't stand between them and the door, because they're going to rush out so fast you'll get run over. But if people perceive that the United States is serious, then I think most of our NATO allies are going to stand in there and stay with us.
Just one quick footnote to that, if I could, as an additional note of appreciation for our allies, because I'm a glass half full person overall on NATO's role in this mission, and I think the overall cohesiveness of the coalition has been fairly impressive. The Canadians have lost close to about 140 soldiers in this war, which on per capita terms, whether you think of it as the size of Canada or the size of their military contribution, is the greatest in the coalition of any major partner, and substantially greater even than ours in proportionate terms. And as Bruce said, they went to Kandahar when none of us really knew how tough the fight was going to be, and they nonetheless carried it out at a time when it was increasingly evident that there were not enough forces in that theater from Canada or anyone else to do the job properly, and yet they still tried their utmost to do the best. And if they stay until mid-2011, that will be through this most crucial 12 to 18 months that General McChrystal and yesterday I Meet the Press General Petraeus have talked about as the defining period. So I'm hopeful that we will continue to see a lot of positive contribution from the Canadians. One more point, and the Germans, by the way, have suffered 35 fatalities, which if you compare the German role in Afghanistan, let's say, to our role in Somalia in the 90s, when we got up to about that threshold of fatalities, we left. And the Germans, with all of their historical issues, have nonetheless toughed it out. Now, I do worry about Taliban attacks on the north and west, designed to create a spectacular kind of incident in which then there's a big political test of a coalition partner like Germany. So that's a worry. but I'm overall impressed by the German steadfastness. One last point, as I say, civilians. Bruce and I think, have both been to a military base up in Canada called Petawawa, for those of you who know your Canadian nomenclature and remote sites, and spoken to a number of their groups of soldiers and civilians. They have a very impressive civilian approach towards this war as well, which is true of the other partners that we've mentioned today. And that's going to be something that's going to be very sad to lose if, in fact, the Canadian PRT in Kandahar City also departs in large fraction once the Canadian troops do. Because a very impressive thing, and we've only begun to accomplish this ourselves with our civilian role in Afghanistan, is that the Canadians were sending dozens of civilians on each rotation to southern Afghanistan, and many of them to the PRT, others to the Kandahar airfield. We've now reached 100 American civilians in the south, which is a big milestone, led by an extraordinarily impressive State Department employee, Frank Ruggiero. We really have now seen a whole level of greater American civilian commitment than before. But the Canadians, like the Dutch and Australians, have been leading the way on some of that, and it will be a shame to lose that. But again, I'm still, on balance, impressed by what they've done and hopeful that another year and a half of combined work will get us a long ways, even if they do wind up departing in 2011.
Okay. I'm not favoring the first tour. I'm just trying to save you the trip. So we'll do this, and then we'll go back.
Emiliano Alessandri from the Institute for International Affairs in Rome, and I would like to ask both speakers to comment on the degree of bipartisanship that the new strategy enjoys here in Washington, and if you see any problem, any tension coming up between the administration and Congress as regards to the budget for both the civilian and military component of the strategy. Thank you.
I'll take a stab at that. I think the irony here is the president has solid Republican support for the war. He is in the unenviable position of depending upon Republican support for the war. It's not that all Democrats have turned against the war, but a substantial part of the Democratic Party over the course of 2009 lost faith in this conflict. War weariness is not unique to Europe. It's true here in the United States as well. There is, I think, after the events of Christmas Day and the failed attempt to bring down Northwest 253, a renewed understanding of the threat and the stakes here, but still there is a substantial war weariness. The irony for the president is, as I said, most of that's in blue states versus red states. No president wants to be dependent upon the opposition for support. All that said, though, it's highly unlikely that the Democrats on the Hill, even those who have doubts about this war, are going to pull the plug on financing it. That would be an extraordinary thing for people to do. I think he's going to enjoy the benefit of support from sufficient number of Democrats and, as I said, the Republicans to be able to do what he wants to do in Afghanistan for the remainder of his first term in office.
Gene Dewey, a former State Department person. You mentioned, and we hear a lot about civilian deaths, but I've seen nothing in the media on the civilian impact of the Marja operation, that is the internally displaced persons. There are probably tens of thousands of them. And one of the toughest things in any military operation is to get the commander to factor in the civilian component, to do a humanitarian impact statement and prepare for the food and the water and the transport and the health care and so forth for those people affected. This could have a major impact on recruiting, too, for the Taliban. I wondered if any of you have any information on whether McChrystal has factored that in his planning. And the second question is, what is the government in a box? What does that consist of? We know what a ministry in a box was in 2002 when I was in Kabul and we worked on ministries in a box. We know how ineffective that was, but how different, if it's different, is a government in a box? Thank you.
Want to divide that one, or do you want to?
Tell it, Mike.
I'll take the first. I don't have complete detail, and thank you for asking the question. I actually worry more about the people inside Marja than the ones who have left. because, as we all know, the military operation, which is ongoing, is largely a helicopter insertion operation because of the IEDs planted in the roadways. And so getting supplies in even for our own troops, as we've been reading in various newspaper accounts and seeing on television, has been a challenge. Getting in supplies for 50,000 residents of Marja who may still be there is even greater. Those who have fled, I think we can take care of reasonably well, although I don't claim to have definitive proof, and I'm glad that you're raising the concern. But certainly in my conversations with General Nicholson and General McChrystal, they were very concerned about every aspect of civilian well-being in this operation, and they've been planning it, as you know, for 3 or 4 months. So that's a general note of confidence, but not quite enough to totally reassure even myself as I answer your question. So I'm glad you continue to keep it on the front burner.
Well, I don't know what a government in a box is any more than you do. It sounds to me like a slogan. But I think the very fact that we have the slogan like that underscores that General McChrystal and his team understand that this is not just about sweeping an area. It's all about what happens the day after. And really, I mean, people are constantly asking, how is the Battle of Marja going? The real answer to that isn't going to come in 6 days or 6 weeks. It's going to be 6, 9 months from now when we see whether the whole strategy of clearing, holding, and building and protecting the population has actually been turned into something real. And that's up to the Afghan government at the end of the day. They are our partner. They are our essential partner. We will find out. You know, that this is, you know, of all the question marks about this strategy, the biggest question mark, I think, has always been about whether the Afghans can stand up and really do it. Based on my experience dealing with the Afghans over many years, I remain relatively optimistic that they will. They're not going to do it like the United States. This isn't going to look like, you know, Massachusetts in the Helmand River Valley. It's going to look like Afghanistan in the Helmand River Valley. Our level of expectation ought to be for Afghans and what Central Asians build in terms of government, not what Americans build in terms of government. But I think they can do it.
Can I get you both at this point to you, Michael, Afghanistan, and Bruce, Pakistan? Give us some metrics, what we look for 6, 9 months or whatever of success.
Thanks, Martha, because in a way, if I'm trying to summarize the book as well, this would be as important as anything we try to do in the book. In some ways, we're just trying to explain Afghanistan, the stakes there, why we think the mission is doable, a bit about the administration's approach, a bit about issues like corruption and reconciliation and so on. But also we want to help people understand the next 18 months, acknowledging that this mission may or may not succeed, even though both Hasina and I are optimists, as Bruce is too, relatively speaking. And when I look for metrics, unfortunately, I don't believe we can expect a reduction in NATO fatalities in 2010. I'm afraid that's not likely to be a leading indicator of progress. I do hope that we can continue to keep a cap and maybe even see a slight reduction in Afghan civilian fatalities, which, by the way, did not go up that much in 2009. And it may have just been that we were better able to measure the fatalities because we were in more of the country than we had been. The total number of Afghan fatalities in 2009 was less than the number per month in Iraq during the height of the violence there. So the violence, as bad as it is, and certainly it's bad for our forces and for Afghan forces, the violence against civilians is not the number one thing to watch either. So part of what you look at is Afghan attitudes about how they feel their government and NATO are doing. And it's sort of strange to gauge a war based on public opinion survey. And yet General McChrystal himself has said this is a war of perception. And to a large extent, especially in sort of a low-grade insurgency like this, it's become more of a medium-grade insurgency with time, but it's still a relatively small amount of violence. What you do have to look for is measures of perception. So I think how the Afghans feel about Karzai, about NATO, about the overall strategy, et cetera, these are important things to look at. And if the polling is to even be half believed, we should be at least temporarily encouraged by what we've seen over the last 6 months in that regard. And I could point to various polls by ABC, BBC, IRI, and other places. The last main area, so I'm talking about violence against troops, NATO and Afghan, and I'm telling you not to expect too much of a reduction in 2010. Violence against civilians, I hope for a small reduction, but the problem's not that serious to begin with, which sounds callous, perhaps, to say, but it's true by the standards of war. So we can't look to civilian fatalities as our number one area of performance improvement either. Perception, this third category, is important. And the other one is progress in the Afghan state and the institutions of the Afghan state, starting with the army and police, obviously, but also extending to instruments of law and order and government in a box, whatever that means. And so you look for people's perceptions on how well government is doing. You look for various metrics of Afghan army and police battlefield performance, recognizing these are very hard to come up with. So you have to look at a lot of different aspects to them. But when you start to get a feel that McChrystal's concept of partnering in an intensive way with Afghan and NATO forces is starting to bring those Afghan forces along to a higher level of performance, that's, for me, perhaps the number one thing that's going to suggest we're making headway.
On the Pakistani side, I think there are a number of indicators that we should look at. I mean, first of all, does this arrest of Mullah Baradar continue? Is there a flow? Do we continue to see the Pakistanis now going after Taliban commanders? If that happens, that means that the sanctuary, the safe haven that the Taliban has enjoyed for the last 9 years in Pakistan is coming to an end. And that's a huge change in the situation. For whatever reason, and, you know, we will debate, I'm sure, endlessly the exact particulars of how this began to happen. I think that's less important than whether there's follow-on and follow-up. A footnote here. Baradar was arrested in Karachi. This follows reports about a month and a half ago that Mullah Omar had moved to Karachi as well. Why did they move to Karachi? Well, the reason, that the single simplest reason, is the drones. The drones made operating in federally administered tribal areas and Northwest Frontier Province more hazardous. And that's clear from the leadership of the Pakistan Taliban, which is now going through their second change in less than a year. Even Quetta, which was for a long time the stronghold of the Taliban, just the reports in the New York Times that the United States was considering using drones over Quetta had an impact. It became, in the minds of the Taliban leadership, too dangerous. Moving to Karachi became the preferred alternative. Now, Karachi is a very difficult place to operate for the government and for us. It's a huge city with a very large Pashtun population, with a large history of being the terror capital of the world. But still, this is progress. Moving them out of the federally administered tribal areas and the border areas is a movement in the right direction. So that's one. Whether we see continued follow-up movements against the Afghan Taliban in Pakistan. A second measure will be how Pakistan's own war against its Taliban proceeds. Mike has given you an appreciation of the civilian casualties on the Afghan side. According to a Pakistani think tank, 25,000 Pakistanis were either killed or wounded in 2009 in terrorism-related violence. 5,000 of them alone in suicide bombings. That's a remarkable figure. This is the most serious internal instability Pakistan has seen in its 60-plus years of history. The country is exhibiting a wave of violence like nothing it has ever really seen before. One of the side effects of that is the Pakistani people, who were for a long time in denial about the threat of jihadism in their own country, have now recognized jihadism in their country is a threat to them. It's a threat to their children. It's a threat to their freedom. That doesn't mean they become pro-American. Far from it. But at least they're now turning on the jihadist or parts of the jihadist syndicate in their country. If that trend continues, that will be a very positive one. And finally, the third and, you know, the $64 million question for us, do we begin to see more and more of the Al-Qaeda core in Pakistan cracking under the pressure that the United States and now Pakistan are putting on them? I think it's always premature to start writing the obituary of Al-Qaeda. Many people have done it, only to be surprised at its agile and resourcefulness. I think there's still an enormous amount of kick left in the Al-Qaeda core. but they are under pressure. And this is, after all, the objective of American policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan, to disrupt, dismantle, and eventually defeat al-Qaeda.
Can I ask one more really quick question and a very quick answer just based on what you just said? I spent the days after Christmas in Yemen, where al-Qaeda has clearly moved. And there was a debate there about what is more dangerous now for the West, for the United States, a fractured al-Qaeda or an al-Qaeda with a command and control, or spreading out to places like Yemen?
I think they're all dangerous. I mean, I don't think there's a preferable option here other than the defeat of al-Qaeda in all of its places.
Well, let's just say they're all dangerous, obviously, but what's harder to go after?
I think it's harder for us to go after if there are multiple power centers. And what's dangerous about what we're seeing al-Qaeda in Yemen doing is it's becoming a power center, not of the same size as the al-Qaeda core, but it is the most successful franchise al-Qaeda has today.
Martha, if I could just add one quick footnote on my earlier point about metrics. I do think, I said before that violence levels I don't expect to be a leading indicator, whether against troops or against civilians. There's a slight exception to that, though, or asterisk, which is in those areas that we've cleared, we should start to see progress fairly soon in levels of violence. And if we don't, especially as we create these contiguous zones, so there aren't sanctuaries like Marja threatening towns like Nawa, if our strategy doesn't improve security in those areas to some measurable extent, then we should worry. So I think we can hope, if not to see nationwide improvements in 2010, to see some local improvements in the overall violence levels.
Thank you very much for your very informative presentation. My name is Mike Moffitt. I'm a Marine Corps Reserve Lieutenant Colonel. I'm a field historian. I'm leaving for Afghanistan on Wednesday, and I'll be speaking to all manner of military people there. Just a question, if you had a chance to pose one or two questions to some folks on the military side, what might you recommend that we ask?
Well, I think understanding the evolution of Afghan security forces is the hardest thing, and therefore where I would spend much of my time with questions, because let me just give you a quick historical parallel. My friend, many of our heroes, and one of the great Americans in modern times, David Petraeus, when he was lieutenant general in Iraq, did not have a great experience in helping build up Iraqi security forces. No one did in that period of time, partly because it was so hard to know how to measure progress, getting back to Martha's question about metrics and effectiveness, and partly because, of course, Iraqi politics trumped a lot of the technical progress he was making at the local level. And you still had very bad and corrupt and sectarian leaders in positions where they could abuse the greater capabilities that Petraeus and others were helping provide them. And in Afghanistan, we are still going to have this issue of how to measure the real value and capability of Afghan security forces. Because it's one thing to measure days in training, number of rifle shots they can take per week in practice, number of times they can hit their mark. But, of course, it's issues of corruption, loyalty to the central government versus loyalty to the tribe or sectarian identity. These are the kinds of things that we need to understand. And measuring them is not straightforward. And one of the great pitfalls of measurement, as we know from our years here at Brookings doing the Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan indices, and you know as a military historian, there's always a temptation to want to value the stuff that's easily measurable, which is often the inputs, and not to value and not to spend a lot of time reflecting on those areas of capability that are harder to measure but perhaps at least as important. And so the basic capability of the Afghan security forces is in that latter category, and that's where I would spend most of my time talking.
Bruce, do you have a question, a quick question?
The Afghan police. It just is a subset of what Mike is talking about. Building the army is hard. Building the police is even more difficult. And how do they think that mission is going?
I want to go to the back here.
Thank you. I'm Tony Smith. I'm going to ask this from the standpoint of a retired Army officer. It's a question for Michael Hanlon and for our moderator, if I may, and also a question that perhaps our military historian might want to probe when he travels over to Afghanistan. I want to go back to the collateral damage issue and rules of engagement, and I want to start from the standpoint that Martha Raddatz raised at the very beginning of our discussion. You mentioned that General Chiarelli had enormous pushback when he suggested rules of engagement similar to what General McChrystal is trying to do in Afghanistan. The question is, well, it's one thing to understand intellectually the importance in winning the hearts and minds not to be in inducing a lot of civilian casualties. It's something quite different when you're taking fire from a location and you want to bring in the heavy artillery and you're not allowed to do so. So my question is, to what extent do you, in your many visits to Afghanistan, the two of you, have any sensing for how well the U.S. troops are buying into General McChrystal's strategy? And secondly, does it influence their behavior in any way? Would they become less aggressive if they're less assured that in taking on a really difficult firefight, they would not get the kind of support that they needed from either artillery or the Air Force?
That's a great question. If I had had a question about the for the military historian, it would have been about that. I will tell you that my most immediate thing that I heard about it was this morning on NPR, and there was a report from an embedded reporter with the Marines, and the Marines sounded very upset by the ROE, and saying, "Look, we and honestly, I don't know whether this the part of this report was accurate." The reporter said, they are not allowed to fire on the Taliban, even if they're fired upon, if they don't see the Taliban with a weapon. And I think that maybe the writing there was a little confusing. I assume that if you have a sniper firing on you, you can fire in the general direction. I'm not sure of that. But she had a whole section talking to the Marines who were really making fun of the rules of engagement, saying, oh, yeah, sir, I've been shot 4 times now. Now can I fire back? And I think, you know, all of this and I know, I mean, I really was over there with General Corelli when he was dealing with this, and I was hearing in town halls when he would say, look, I'm just asking when someone approaches at a checkpoint that you make sure you go through, now I fire at the tires, now I fire to this. These are split-second decisions. These are the most complicated, life-threatening decisions anyone has to make. But I am concerned if people and if Marines and soldiers over there are thinking, wait a minute, I can't fire, or should I fire? I mean, this group of Marines sounded, frankly, quite confused about the rules of engagement. And all of that goes back to leadership, whether it's the platoon level, whatever level you are at, it's a leadership issue that they have to tell them, or I think you have a real problem. I mean, I thought it was really interesting when McChrystal first came out with this and thinking back to General Corelli and what he had gone through. It's also parents. You know, parents watch the news and say, and they or they get, you know, Facebook by their kids saying, hey, we're not allowed to shoot back at the Taliban unless we, you know, ID them. That may not be the case, but then the parents start being concerned about that. Then Congress starts being concerned about that. And I think in Iraq, that's what happened with that period of history and when they were trying to adjust the rules of engagement.
I think that's well said. I would just add as a note, and without presuming to understand the full details of this debate inside the military, that it's obviously going to vary to some extent from different positions to others. And there, certainly if you're an individual soldier or Marine who thinks your life's been put at risk even once by the requirement to show more restraint in the use of firepower, you could feel some serious angst about that. For the non-commissioned officers and the junior officers, though, if they see the strategy working, if they see themselves developing intelligence networks with the local population, which starts to trust them because it views them in a more friendly manner, I think that will catch on fairly quickly. Mentioning Iraq, one of the things I was struck by in July 2007 in my visit there with Ken Pollack and Tony Cordesman was how much the junior officers were buying into the surge by then, because they were already seeing it work locally. It hadn't yet started to work at a convincing, demonstrable, nationwide level to everyone's satisfaction, obviously. But for many of the junior officers, they were confident for the first time that they had a military strategy that gave them some hope of winding up in a better place at the end of their tour strategically than they had been at the beginning. And I think that's going to be the question.
And I just want to give another personal thing. I remember going, you go to these briefings every morning, and usually in those briefings for senior officers and everybody, it's how many did you kill today, how did you do that? And Corelli had a real change of he wanted to hear how many people weren't killed at a particular incident. Who did pause? How did you do this? Then what happened next? And that is exactly what Michael's talking about. That gave them some evidence to show, look, a car approached. We didn't kill the person. It turned out it was an innocent driver. We got out. We engaged with the people. Word spread throughout the village. That sort of thing was rewarded. And that is, I'm certain, the kind of effort that General McChrystal is trying to make as well. I think we have time for one more question. Let's, the woman in the very back.
Nancy Berg, Project on National Security Reform. Just wanted to ask another question on metrics on the civilian side, whether you would have a comment for Afghanistan on the civilian well-being, some of that kind of thing, not the political, but welfare, health, education, any other kind of measurements like that, or how assets are flowing to the region.
And let's do that PAC Afghanistan, too, because you had all those displaced people and from the Swat Valley and everywhere else. Bruce, if you want to start.
Well, the numbers and the data on the Pakistani side is different than on the Afghan side. On the Afghan side, we're able to get data largely collected by NATO, by CENTCOM, by ISAF, and I think we have a relatively good feel for its accuracy. On the Pakistani side, the data is much more squishy, and efforts to find permanent homes for IDPs in the Swat Valley in South Waziristan has not progressed very effectively, and the Pakistani military has not been very open about allowing journalists into those places to see what's going on. So it's very hard to get to that kind of information. More broadly, numbers on what's going on in Pakistan. I gave you the 25,000 killed or wounded figure. That's from a Pakistani think tank. I don't think that we could confirm that number in any way whatsoever. We just have to rely on Pakistani sources and deal with the data that we have from them. The polling in Pakistan, though, is pretty consistent, and it does show this trend I discussed, this kind of backlash. And we've now seen a number of polls, and I think they all are telling us basically the same thing. Pakistanis were in denial a year ago about the problem they have. That has changed. And that change in Pakistani public opinion has made it possible for the Pakistani army to change its policy as well, because it feels that it is not going against the tide of Pakistani people's wishes. Again, it's not raging pro-Americanism by any count. We're still more unpopular in Pakistan than even India, and that's a pretty deep, deep hole to be in. But we have seen some movement towards Pakistanis agreeing with us that we have a common enemy in the jihadist syndicate.
Just a couple of quick words on Pakistan, then moving over to Afghanistan to conclude. Even Ian Livingston and I, who do the Pakistan Index here, have noticed this difficulty in getting data. On the other hand, the Pakistanis do have a lot of very good documentation on these areas, but they're aware themselves of their own limited resources to put civilian capacity into the Northwest Frontier Province and the Fatah in what's essentially the build phase. So like us, they have a problem in the build phase. Like us, they're recognizing it. And, you know, if that awareness is the first step towards recovery, I was encouraged in the strategic dialogue last Tuesday in Doha and in other interventions and conversations with Pakistanis that they are aware of the need to do more on the build side. But that's easier said than done. On Afghanistan, you know, it's fairly easy to tell a feel-good story about improvement in people's lives because what you're comparing to, if you look at statistical trends, is years first of Soviet invasion, then civil war and anarchy, and then Taliban rule. And measured against those three periods, which dominated the last quarter century until 2001, things are much better today. And this is one of the areas of talking points that many of us observed and listened to government officials tout through those early years of the ISAF presence when we hoped that Afghanistan was going to be at least a limited success story. Because whether it's 7 million kids now in school, as opposed to less than 1 million under the Taliban, 7 million telephone users, as opposed to maybe a few hundred thousand, probably a few tens of thousands under the Taliban, number of girls in school, well over 2 million today, virtually zero under the Taliban, economic growth rate, admittedly driven largely by foreign aid and opium, so that's not healthy. It's an artificial stimulus, but the growth rates are in the 10 to 15% per year range. These kind of numbers are not that bad. The problem is, of course, that with the security environment deteriorating, it doesn't mean that much because people worry first and foremost about security, and secondly, they wonder if all those improvements in human welfare are really sustainable in the absence of a security environment that holds together. Because again, even if the security environment has not been horrible per se in terms of fatalities against civilians, it's been headed all in the wrong direction for a half decade. And so I would like to take more comfort in the good news on the economic and human welfare side than I find I'm able to do. I think until we arrest the deterioration of the security environment, we're still going to be in some jeopardy. But let me finish on a more positive note. I actually think we have arrested the deterioration of the security environment. But I think we're sort of at a plateauing stage. And the plateau right now is not sustainable, obviously. If it requires 70 to 100,000 U.S. troops losing 200 to 300 soldiers per year, allies, you know, with almost comparable contributions and investments, we have to do much better than, you know, level things off. We have to actually build up an Afghan state that can do this job increasingly on its own. So again, in 2010, watch for Afghans' perceptions, local progress in the places where we've added a lot of forces, and early signs that the Afghan institutions are performing better. And those are the three areas where I'd like to leave you with my emphasis.
Thank you all very much. And here's Michael's book again.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much.